Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest shooting of police officers, this time in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where a sniper with a similar military background as the shooter in Dallas ambushed police officers, killing three and wounding three more. The award-winning investigative journalist who has covered the police and the criminal justice system for decades, Joe Dominic, joins us to discuss how police forces around the country are reacting to the possibility that they are becoming targets of the rampant gun violence in America. Joe is the Associate Director of the Center for Media, Crime and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the author of a number of books on policing, the latest of which is Blue, The Ruin and Redemption of the LAPD. Then on this first day of the Republican convention in Cleveland, we'll examine the extent to which the GOP has become the party of angry white people headed by a racist demagogue who was the leading voice of the birther movement that has sought to delegitimize America's first African-American president with the claim that he is a stealth Kenyan, not an American, nefariously out to undermine America with a hidden agenda that Trump just hinted at on Fox News with the claim that Obama's body language suggested he is in favor of shooting cops. Alan Abramowitz, a professor of political science at Emory University and author of Voice of the People, Elections and Voting Behavior in the United States, joins us to discuss the demographics of the angry white voter and why they believe in Trump and his not-so-coded dog-whistle racist messages. Then finally, we will speak with a longtime former senior House and Senate staffer, Mike Lofgren, the author of The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. He joins us to discuss his latest article at Consortium News, How the Right Tears Down America, and why Trump's call to make America great again resonates with working Americans who do not feel they are benefiting from the fact that the world's 11th largest firms in terms of market capitalization are American-based. And joining us now is Joe Dominic, an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and associate director of the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's the author of To Protect and Serve, The LAPD Century of War in the City of Dreams, and Cruel Justice, Three Strikes, and the Politics of Crime in America's Golden State. His latest book is Blue, The Ruin and Redemption of the LAPD. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe Dominic.
Great to talk to you as always, Ian.
Well, thank you, Joe. And you've made a career out of investigating the police and their relationship to the community, and particularly the evolution of the LAPD from an extremely sort of militarized right-wing operation to its current incarnation. And I take it that, well, first of all, in all the years that you've covered police and police issues, Joe, have you ever seen a moment like this where now police in America feel that they themselves are becoming targets?
Well, it is an extraordinary moment, and we did have in New York City police being assassinated during the 1970s. I believe there were maybe six or seven. But this is a whole new era and a whole new time, and I think that that American policing is facing its greatest crisis since the early 90s, when New York City was having 2,000 homicides a year. California was passing the harshest, most rigid, most unjust three strikes law, any law ever passed in America. So that was just because of a hysteria over crime, some of which was well grounded. Things were somewhat out of control in a lot of areas during those years. But this is something entirely new, and there are a lot of entirely new circumstances surrounding it that I think are pretty interesting, and one of the reasons that we see it coming to fruition right now.
But obviously, nobody wants to justify what happened in Dallas and in Baton Rouge, but there is this fact that much of the police shootings of innocent civilians, which have been documented usually by video, they have essentially they've all been acquitted except for the policeman down in South Carolina, which was a pretty flagrant act when he shot a fleeing suspect in the back, and that was caught on video. But how much do you think the fact that Freddie Gray's accusers seem to have gotten off and the other accusers in other shootings, and the most recent two, of course, are still being investigated. But how do you factor that in, the idea that on the one hand, people are appalled at the idea of the police being shot by snipers. On the other hand, there is this appearance that police simply get away with shooting civilians.
Well, I think there are a variety of reasons, and I think the issues are complex, Ian. Certainly, one of the issues is the relationship between African Americans and American police forces, which has always been abysmal, which has for most of our history has been one of repression, one of brutality, and one of the enforcement of segregation. And the policy of checking out every African American that you see outside of the ghetto to find out what they're doing in a white neighborhood, that was just kind of a tradition. So there's always been this hatred of the police. There's always been this brutality of the police, which African Americans have been talking about for centuries. And nobody, you know, most white people didn't believe until the beating of Rodney King. And then, of course, then we had the revolution in technology, where everybody is now, you know, everybody walking down the street that has a camera with himself or herself, and is capturing things that normally would have made like, you know, one or two sentences in the Los Angeles Times or any other local newspaper, are now, you know, cause celebs, because it's pretty clear that a lot of these shootings could have been avoided. So, you know, that's one part of the situation of why these shootings of police officers occurred. But there's, I think, other reasons. One of them has been just the mass shootings that we've just grown accustomed to over the last 4, 5, 6, or 7 years, whether it's school children in Connecticut or it's nightclubbers in Orlando, or now cops in Dallas and in Baton Rouge. So there's just this this idea planted in the minds of you know, every disgruntled, angry, pissed off, or a mentally ill person, that they can go out and, you know, have their last stand and you know, become famous for their 15 minutes of fame. So this is one of the things that also has factored into it. The ordinariness of this, and then I see that coupled with what happened in Nice, what the events in Paris, in Belgium, in all of these countries, and San Bernardino, all of these. So we have all of these terrorist and non-terrorist shootings, and it's become like Buckminster Fuller's global village. What happens in Paris, or what happens in Nice, or what happens in Belgium is the same as what happens in it's covered with the same intensity by CNN, MSNBC, Fox News. It's wall-to-wall coverage, 24/7, you know, of just people being inundated with this. So it becomes really part of the cultural DNA, and it becomes it just becomes an ordinary thing. So it's not surprising that a couple of angry black guys, both of whom were military veterans who were trained in the military, deciding that they were going to do that, and they were going to do it to the police because they were angry at the police. So it's this, and it, of course, it's the NRA. And what can we say about the NRA except that they daily are killing American people? Let's say it. Let's be frank, and let's say it. These people are the enablers of murderers. So, you know, that's the situation as I see it.
And again, I'm speaking with Joe Dominick, an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and the associate director of the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's the author of To Protect and Serve, the LAPD Century of War in the City of Dreams, and Cruel Justice, Three Strikes in the Politics of Crime in America's Golden State. And his latest book is Blue, The Ruin and Redemption of the LAPD. Well, Joe, just picking up on what you just said, though, one of the police chiefs down in Baton Rouge went out of his way to say this has nothing to do, the shooting of the police officers has nothing to do with guns. I don't know whether he's an NRA member, but most police aren't happy with the NRA, from what I've understood. And also the smart police chiefs are.
Right, Charlie Beck, Bill Bratton. The smart ones are don't want people out on the street carrying guns. Look what's going to happen. What could happen in Cleveland, an open carry state?
Right. Well, the police union head has asked the governor of Ohio to temporarily rescind the open carry law, and Governor Kasich has said he can't do that. So there's an example of the union of the police saying this is crazy.
This is another of the problems that have led to this disastrous situation. The police unions and the police establishment in general is very, very, very resistant to change, Ian. Even though this is not the 1990s, the data is in. We know what works and can be effective in preventing crime, preventing violence, and preventing police violence. We know what has to be done, but there is not the political will. The Republicans are in the pocket of the NRA. The Democrats really do seem to have gotten the message. I thought that President Obama's speech in Dallas the other day was just magisterial and so right on the money in terms of exactly what's happening and what needs to be done. He said it a lot more articulately than I'm saying it now. But so he understands the analysis, and there are a lot of cops that understand the analysis, too. I just spoke to 27 of them, LAPD officers, the other day. I was asked to give a lecture, and they were in the class, self-selected. They want to be involved in community policing. And a lot of them understood how badly they were being used, how ill-funded they are, how they're caught in between, dangerous situations and making dangerous and, you know, often faulty decisions because they're scared. You know, it's not just racism. I don't think there's too many cops out there say, let's go kill a couple of black guys.
Well, Joe Dominic, when you mentioned President Obama's recent speech in Dallas, and then he just gave a response to the shooting in Baton Rouge of police officers yesterday, and Donald Trump, who's about to head up the convention in Cleveland today and introduce his wife this evening, he, on Fox, did this extremely irresponsible dog whistle act where he said, well, Obama's words were okay, but his body language, there's something going on. There's something going on. I mean, this is the king of the birther movement. There's something going on.
People have been telling him there's something going on. What can I say about Donald Trump that hasn't already been said?
But I'm saying that to have a public figure of his stature, the person who's heading up the second of our two major parties in this country, spread that kind of conspiracy implication that the President of the United States is actually somehow in collusion with radical African Americans who want to kill police officers is just the height of irresponsibility. And I don't know.
He did the same thing with Muslims. He said, after one of the attacks, he said that something doesn't make sense here. There's something going on that he's not taking this seriously enough. So this is nothing new, but it's also nothing new to just Donald Trump. I mean, we're old enough to remember George H.W. Bush, and what was the fellow up in Boston who got the weekend leave?
Willie Horton.
That was about as crude and racist as you can get. You know that the governor of Massachusetts at the time was running, Dukakis, was, you know, some kind of enabler of all of this. Mm-hmm. So it's nothing new. The Republicans have been using this, you know, ever since Richard Nixon.
So what is their prescription then? Do you know what Trump is going to suggest?
You know, some conservatives have really gotten religion on this issue in a good way because they don't want to pay for prisons. They don't want to pay this incredible cost of the criminal justice system. So there has been movement, but they don't have any prescription prescriptions other than the ones that you heard from Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, the good ones. You know, there are still some good ones, I guess. But it's also the police establishment and their antipathy towards Barack Obama. I was monitoring a panel on policing in John Jay a couple of months ago, the panel was about the President's Commission on Police in America, and so one of the panelists, a very very esteemed criminologist, said that he didn't think any of the suggestions would be adopted. And I said, why not? And he said, because these police chiefs out there just hate Obama, and they won't do anything that has his imprimatur on it, you know, his name on it. So that's a big problem. So we have to remember, Ian, that this is the time where we have to support good cops. And there are a lot more good, thoughtful cops who have a reasonable analysis of what's going on and what needs to be done, who are trying to do something about that. They even have an organization of about 150 police chiefs and district attorneys. And so, you know, for example, Charlie Beck. This is a time that Charlie Beck should really be supported as LAPD chief, because he and the police commission. And it hasn't been easy for any of them. You know, I've come through with body cameras, new de-escalation training that has consequences if the de-escalation isn't followed, and a real try at community policing, a real try at not being arrogant and not insulting the intelligence of the public with stupid excuses for doing stupid things. So these are men and women that really do need to be supported, because we got to have cops. And this is, and given the surveillance capabilities of the government, Ian, nothing cannot be found out. So unless we have people that are committed to a kind of democratic policing and a democratic enforcement, we are in very big trouble. So the police are very important also in a kind of a futuristic scenario as well as right now.
But why is it, though, Joe Dominic, that the majority of the police chiefs in this country hate Obama? Is it because of the fact that the Republican and Fox News hate machine over the last 7.5 years has literally created the conditions of hating the president and giving permission with these dog whistle coded messages that, and Trump is railing against political correctness, which is an excuse to have permission to be racist. And we're heading in that direction. So I'm not, are there any practical and on the record rational reasons for why the police in this country don't support Obama, who has not been an enemy of the police, as far as I can tell? And
for a lot of cops, if you're not a full-throated 100% supporter, then you hate the cops. That's the old cop mentality. So that's number one. Number two, in terms of Obama himself, he has been. A more intelligent observer about what's going on, an extremely intelligent observer about what's going on. So maybe they don't like that. But, I mean, who are the 40% or 50% of the people in this country, 40% at least, who hate Obama? What's wrong with the guy? You know, you look at him, I look at him and say, what's the hate about the guy? You might not agree with his policies, but has there ever been a more polite, more genial, more elegant, you know, more respectable and decent guy as president of the United States? I don't remember, so I can't talk to that. But I can say this about the whole attitude that goes back, as far as I'm concerned, to Rush Limbaugh. Limbaugh has made a career throughout this country in all of these little states and little places off the beaten path, taking everything the Democrats say and do and putting the most nefarious spin on it, so that anything they do, He comes up with a logical reason why they're trying to screw the American people. And so, and that and his cohorts became enormously popular in the 90s. And then came Fox News. So I think that the reason we're divided is because Rush Limbaugh has found this, and his ilk and Fox News have found a way to give people information, but it's all tainted information. It's all information designed to make anything that the Democrats do be nefarious. There's something wrong with everything that they do, and they're nefarious, and they're sneaky, and they're trying to put one over on the pure American folks. And that, I think, has seeped in, because remember, with Limbaugh, it goes back to the 80s. I've been listening to the guy since the 80s, so I know. And I think that has just infiltrated the culture of rural America and many of the people who are smart but not educated, who are informed but are ill-informed.
Right.
And that's why America is divided, and I think that includes an awful lot of police officers.
But I don't, just in closing, what's the difference between Rush Limbaugh and Donald Trump in terms of what they say and what they believe?
Limbaugh's a voice, and Trump's an action figure.
I see. Oh, well, that's even a scary note to end on. I thank you very much for joining us, Joe Dominic.
Thank you for calling me, my friend. Good to talk to you, as always.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Joe Dominic, who's an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and associate director of the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's the author of To Protect and Serve, the LAPD Century of War in the City of Dreams, and Cruel Justice, Three Strikes, and the Politics of Crime in America's Golden State. And his latest book is Blue, The Ruin and Redemption of the LAPD. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the GOP has become the party of angry white people. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alan Abramowitz, who's a professor of political science at Emory University and an expert on national politics, polling, and elections, who studies election forecasting models, party realignment in the United States, congressional elections, and the effects of political campaigns on the electorate. His election forecast has correctly and precisely predicted the popular vote winner within 2 percentage points or less in every U.S. presidential election since 1988, and he's the author of Voice of the People, Elections and Voting Behavior in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Abramowitz.
Glad to be with you.
And you're quoted extensively in terms of whether or not what we're going to be witnessing this week in Cleveland, the Republican National Convention, whether or not we'll see the GOP turn into the White People's Party. I'm sure that the handful of minorities in attendance will be up front and close to the cameras. But what's your overall sense of the perception that is likely to be on display, both in and outside mm-hmm. of the convention?
Well, if we look at both the delegates to the Republican convention, the leaders of the party, the congressional membership of the party, and the voters who support the party, we can see that it is an overwhelmingly white party. That has not changed very much, even as the country has become increasingly diverse. So if you just trace the trend in the percentage of Republican voters, elected officials, and leaders who are non-white, it has just not, it has not gone up, as even though the country itself has been, has become increasingly non-white.
So is this the sort of legacy of Richard Nixon's Southern strategy that was written about by Kevin Phillips?
In part, certainly Nixon led the way in terms of the transformation of the Republican Party in reaching out to disgruntled conservative white voters, especially in the South, but other places as well, in the aftermath of the Civil Rights Revolution. And so, you know, what Nixon started or continued was this regional realignment of American politics, where the South has become the strongest Republican region of the country, the most Republican region of the country, whereas in the 1950s and 60s, it was the most Democratic region of the country. And going along with that regional realignment, of course, has been an ideological realignment. The Republican Party has become a much more conservative party than it was 30 or 40 years ago. And so we see this growing ideological as well as regional and racial divide between the two parties.
Well, you're quoted widely in a number of major newspapers and the Associated Press today, Alan Abramowitz, saying in terms of the mantra of Donald Trump's take our country back and make America great again, appeals to lesser educated whites who wish to return to an era when a college degree was not necessary to earn a middle class living and the population was overwhelmingly white. He's trying to appeal to a sense of displacement, a sense of being left out, of being left behind. Elect me and we'll finally have a leader who will undo all of these terrible things. So you think that's going to be pretty much the theme of this convention?
Oh, I think that will be a major theme of this convention. Racial resentment, resentment of changes in the makeup of the American population, resentment of immigrants, but you know, also certainly we'll hear a lot of attacks on Obama and Clinton and the Democrats as the kind of leaders of this changing electorate, those who represent the other side. I think we're going to see that highlighted over and over again at the Republican convention.
So can we, in trying to be fair and balanced, as they say, can we assume that because Donald Trump has been one of the major proponents of the birther movement for some time, going back quite a while, he has insisted that President Obama is not even an American, that he's a Kenyan with anti-colonial feelings and doesn't have a valid birth certificate. This is, of course, is a fairly flagrant way to delegitimize somebody, but it also has racial overtones. And the sense is
Absolutely.
But isn't the evidence pretty clear that since Obama has been president, there's been all of these dog whistles that have become, you know, extremely loud of late. And just yesterday, in response to the shooting of police officers in Baton Rouge, the president made a statement, which immediately Donald Trump criticized on Fox News by suggesting, in a dog whistle way, that there's something going on here. He said, you know, his words may be okay,
right,
but his body language, you know, there's something going on. There's
right.
Something. What in God's name is that except dog whistle implications that this
right.
guy is somehow un-American or not standing up for the cops?
Yeah, Trump does this over and over again, suggests, and he's not the only one, but he's certainly been one of the most prominent proponents of this line of argument and criticism of the president, suggesting that, you know, he's not really loyal to this country, that he's governing in the interest of trying to weaken the country, that he is not a true American, even by birth, you know, and certainly there is a significant racial component to that, as there is to the sort of comments that Trump repeatedly has made about Mexican immigrants. Referring to them as rapists and criminals, and this whole idea of building a wall on the border and rounding up and deporting undocumented immigrants. Again, this is designed to appeal to a substantial segment of the Republican electorate who are very upset about the way the country is changing. And more recently, we've seen that Trump has aligned himself with the concerns of religious conservatives who are very upset about the way the culture is changing. And even though Trump himself has never really been associated with those positions, he is very much playing to the fears and resentment that are felt by that group as well.
Of course, we're a little ahead of ourselves in terms of wanting a prediction here, Alan Abramowitz, but as this convention begins, there is, I assume, that a lot of the people that are supporting Trump are supporting him not for these sort of coded messages, dog whistles, you know, this that he keeps putting forth, the idea that somehow political correctness has taken over. And I think the clear message there is that that's another coded way of saying that we need our permission to be racist again, and somehow political correctness as a social convention has somehow restrained us from being our true selves. But just putting aside the racist component, and I'm not sure there's any way to really judge that because people aren't really open about their feelings on that matter, and everybody denies that they're a racist. How many do you think, or how much of the support that Trump is getting is really also about the other thing that you mentioned about the economic sense of being an endangered species and the downsizing, the outsourcing, and all of that that's going on?
That's certainly part of his appeal. If you look at the demographics of the Trump electorate in the Republican primaries, he did best with more downscale voters in most of the states. He did best with those with less education, those without a college degree, those who are most likely to be upset about the economic changes, as well as the other changes we talked about. So I think that was a component of his appeal, but I have to say that, you know, from the evidence I've looked at, that is really more of a secondary factor, and that really the racial resentment and nativism are more powerful in explaining his appeal. Because there actually are quite a lot of better educated folks who supported Trump in the primaries. You know, he did quite well in the Northeast, for example, among Republicans, in states like Massachusetts and New York. It was quite remarkable that he was able to win the primaries in those states by big margins. And he wasn't just appealing to, you know, the uneducated and the down and out folks. That, you know, they were certainly there as part of his base, but he pulled in a lot of better educated folks where there's even there, among Republican voters, it's a very strong resentment toward the changes taking place in the country, toward immigrants and deep hostility toward the first African American president as well.
So you don't think, though, that the Democrats could address these themes that animate some of his voters, if not the majority of Trump's voters? And that is, of course, the very same themes, and a lot of comparisons were made to the campaign of Trump and that of Bernie Sanders on the left. So are the Democrats missing out on something here, or do you think it's simply about racism and therefore really at the end of the day it's really in effect a judgment of America itself in terms of the better angels of our nature?
Well, I think it's a minority of the electorate that these messages appeal to. There certainly are some similarities between some of the issues raised by Sanders and the issues raised by Trump, particularly with regard to the effects, the impact of some of the trade agreements on jobs and manufacturing in the United States. If you look at the supporters of those two candidates, you find that they have very little in common otherwise. Their attitudes on a whole range of issues and their views of the other party and the other candidate are very, very negative. So Sanders voters, by and large, have a very negative view of Trump. which is why I think in the end it's very unlikely that many of them will end up voting for Trump. And you know, Trump voters on the other side don't really care for Sanders. So, you know, I think they're appealing to largely distinctive separate groups. You can always find isolated individuals who might be attracted to both, but that's a pretty small minority of voters.
Well, I was also, though, wanting to know from you if indeed there is something the Democrats could do to win over these disaffected voters that are going to vote for Trump on the basis of his appeal to the endangered workers in this country. And I'm not sure that what can be done in terms of the other factor that we've been focusing on here, which is racism, whether there's any way to undo racism or whether Hillary Clinton can win over people with an appeal to their better angels.
I think it's possible for Clinton and Democrats to appeal to a fairly large segment of white working class voters with a message that specifically targets their economic concerns and that focuses not just on trade but on the need to provide assistance to these people, to provide economic programs that will generate jobs and provide, for example, training to trade adjustment programs, the kinds of things that Trump and other Republicans really don't even talk about. So in targeting the resentment that many of these voters feel about not just trade, but also the idea of immigrants coming in and taking away their jobs, you find that the Republicans almost never talk about what could be done to try to create economic growth and good jobs in some of these communities where the manufacturing jobs are gone and they're not coming back. I mean, it's just not realistic to think that you're going to be able to bring back the jobs that have been lost over the last 30 years. And this all began, you know, long before NAFTA, for example. So what essentially Trump's message does is it's just appealing to people's anger and resentment, but without really providing anything in the way of a kind of a positive, practical message of what, you know, how to deal with these concerns and problems. If Democrats, I think, can address those concerns and problems in a more positive way, I think they can make inroads there. I think they can win back some of those voters. It's certainly not going to win back most of them, because, again, I think the concerns over immigration and the racial resentment that's there is something that, obviously, the Democrats are not going to try to appeal to.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, the New York Times, in its Monday edition, in its editorial, has pointed out that the Secretary of State of Kansas, Chris Kobach, has had enormous influence over the platform, and he's an extremely partisan. They'd refer to him as a Republican zealot, a right-wing zealot who has in many ways shaped the party platform for this convention. And, of course, the fact that he's from Kansas reminds me of Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas, and his latest book, Listen, Liberal. He goes after the Democrats in a quite incisive way for what you just talked about, is the, you know, how, what we were just talking about, is how do you win back these disaffected working class voters, particularly white men. And of course, his point is this is a long time process, the alienation of the working class base of the Democratic Party, the tilt to Wall Street under Bill Clinton, etc. So do you accept some of his thesis, Thomas Franks, and that if it's taken a long while to lose these people, it's going to take a long while to win them back?
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. Although I think, again, that he's probably underestimating the appeal of racial resentment and resentment of immigrants and immigration as a factor in that. And over and above any economic issues and concerns. You know, I think the appeal of racial resentment and fear is something that's been around for a long time. We've seen conservatives play on this since the 1960s, at least, in trying to win over formerly Democratic voters. And it kind of goes back to the fact that the Democratic Electoral Coalition, the old New Deal coalition, going back to the 1950s and 60s, was really kind of an inherently unstable coalition, because you had in there, and particularly as the African-American electorate began to grow in size with after the Voting Rights Act, and immigration began to change the demographic makeup of the electorate, and Democrats were becoming increasingly dependent on votes of African-Americans and later Latinos and other non-whites, that you were going to be able to hold on to the votes of these less educated white working class voters. When we talk about the working class today in America, we have to remember that a very large segment of the working class in this country today is non-white. And so if you look at the overall patterns of support within the electorate, I mean, you find that working class voters, if you look across all racial groups, still tilt pretty strongly Democratic. So less educated white voters who are tilting towards the GOP these days, you know, have been trending Republican for many, many years. I think you could go all the way back to the 1960s and certainly the 1970s. Whether it has much to do with a tilt toward Wall Street or a sense that the Democrats are no longer, you know, the party of labor and the party of the working class, there's probably some truth to that, but you know, in terms of the economic policies the two parties stand for, the kinds of tax policies they stand for example, in terms of their policies toward organized labor, certainly, it's pretty clear, I think, that the Democratic Party remains much more supportive of an agenda that would be have positive consequences for the working class.
Well, I guess it remains to be seen in the end, Alan Abramowitz, whether angry white working class voters will more likely to vote than angry working class minority voters who are less likely to vote.
The white working class, you know, is still very important. Obviously, whites without a college education still make up a large segment of the electorate, but it is a shrinking segment of the electorate. So to be counting on kind of increased turnout and support from a shrinking segment of the electorate, I think, is a very risky strategy. And we saw that in 2012. Not that Romney was Romney is a very different sort of candidate from Trump in many ways, but, you know, I think a lot of Republican strategists thought that the Democrats and Obama would not be able to replicate the success they had in 2008. Would not be able to put together the kind of coalition, generate the kind of turnout from minority voters, for example, from younger voters that they got in 2008. And actually, they didn't to quite the same extent. But again, you have the demographics just keep shifting. Every election cycle, the electorate is becoming less white in this country. And by doubling down on racially resentful white working class voters, I think the Republican Party is making a losing bet. And a lot of the leaders of the Republican Party recognize this. And, you know, that was the point, I think, of the postmortem that they did after the last election, which they've completely ignored in the last year. And you know, that's the view that's held, I think, by a lot of the smarter Republican strategists, people like Whit Ayers, who's talked about the fact that Republicans can't hope to win a national election unless they can increase their share of the non-white vote. They just can't keep counting on increasing the turnout or the share of white working class voters and as a strategy for winning a national election. So right now, their strategy seems to be primarily to hope to increase the turnout and white share of the electorate, and also to try to suppress the minority vote.
Alan Abramowitz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Enjoy talking to you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Alan Abramowitz, who's a professor of political science at Emory University and an expert on national politics, polling, and elections, who studies election forecasting models, party realignment in the United States, congressional elections, and the effects of political campaigns on the electorate. His election forecasters correctly and precisely predicted the popular vote winner within 2 percentage points or less in every U.S. presidential election since 1988. And he's the author of Voice of the People, Elections and Voting Behavior in the United States. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why Trump's call to make America great again resonates with working Americans. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster release, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And he has an article at Consortium News, How the Right Tears Down America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be here, Ian.
And on this first day of the Republican convention in Cleveland, I take it Mike Lofgren, being a recovering Republican, do you recognize your party anymore? The GOP having clearly become a white people's party.
No, I don't recognize it, although I've seen for several years what it was becoming, and that's the reason I got out. It's becoming this group that's relentlessly and sourly negative on all kinds of aspects of American life, and they believe that they are the saving grace, the real America. But if you count up the people they dislike and don't consider real Americans, ethnic minorities, religious minorities, women who don't want to be subjugated, gays, anybody who has a more libertarian view of what people privately and consensually do, people who don't necessarily want to be militants all the time, then they represent the minority in America, yet they think they are the true patriots. And the real irony there is these patriots don't really like the America that exists. And some of them would subvert the constitutional order that they claim to support, such as Trump, quote-unquote, opening up the libel laws to prevent anyone from criticizing him, which is a violation of the First Amendment.
Well, Trump, of course, is going to appear briefly this evening, on the first evening of the Republican convention, to introduce his wife, who has been described as a sort of Stepford wife, in the sense that she seems like one of these Eastern European mail-order brides, one of the Natashas that you can acquire online. But
I think Natasha in Rocky and Bullwinkle was far more independent.
Right. But, of course, the point that she will be making is that she was an immigrant to this country and did it the legal way. So, again, it seems that the focus is on the other. So what is your opinion of what Trump means and what clearly has resonated with these followers, that we're going to make America great again, one, and we're going to take back America? I assume that they're referring to an America of the Ozzie and Harriet days when blacks and Latinos were invisible.
Well, it doesn't even include that, because I think if you consider his policies, it's really a bridge to about the 17th century in terms of the social strife and absolutism it will create. I mean, the 50s definitely had their regressive aspects, which were an inheritance of everything else that came before in America's history. But at least the economics were progressive. Eisenhower did not want to lower the 91.5% marginal income tax rate on the richest group for all kinds of reasons, whereas Trump is going to increase the deficit $10 trillion over the next 10 years if he's elected, enacting tax cuts for the rich. There's no comparison there. Eisenhower instituted all kinds of progressive things. He created Health and Human Services. He created the interstate highway system and so forth. He even wrote to his brother Milton Eisenhower, "There are some people who want to abolish Social Security. These people are cranks, like H.L. Hunt, the billionaire, so let's just disregard them."
Well, it's but we live in an America where the billionaires have all but taken over, and arguably we've become more of an oligarchy than a democracy of late, and it does seem extremely ironic that working-class Americans would elect a billionaire, even though he may not be as rich as he says he is. So there's always been aspirational politics, hasn't there? I mean, isn't it what essentially comes down to with Trump is it's the sort of political equivalent of the Powerball. You know, you vote for me and somehow, you know, the fairy dust is going to, you know, trickle down off me onto you.
Well, it's exactly the same as the sort of name-it-and-claim-it wealth gospel of the televangelists. If you ask, why do working-class people support Trump, you should ask why working-class people go into megachurches and give offerings to people showing off, you know, their Gulfstream jet or their Armani suit and their Rolex watch. They think that's somehow going to trickle down to them with a faith offering, but of course it's just a scam.
Well, what's your sense then of how the assuming that Hillary Clinton gets some kind of narrative going with her campaign, which so far I'm not sure what it stands for. At least Trump has put out some simplistic notions of make America great again. She said, well, we don't, America is already great. Well, that's not how a lot of people feel. People are, you know, if they may be wrong for why they're in their belief that Trump's going to help them, but they nevertheless are gravitating because they're angry about the way that things are. But as you point out in your article in Consortium News, Mike Lofgren, how the right tears down America. The idea that America is somehow diminished and is on the decline is ridiculous. As you point out, the 11th largest firms in the world by market capitalization are U.S.-based, and companies like Google and Apple are basically the companies of the future, and they're all American companies. But the perception's nevertheless there, isn't it? So the facts may be that America is not in decline, but the perception that it is. So what can be done to reverse that? Because people don't feel that they're sharing in America's bounty.
Right. It has the potential to be much greater than it is. This notion of an inevitable decline is simply wrong. It's not comporting with the facts. Hillary Clinton is so flat-footed, she cannot seem to articulate that. She says America is great, but she doesn't back it up with any facts. If you look at us on an international basis, sure, we took some hits from the 2008 crash, and that was largely engineered on Wall Street, but Obama's stimulus plan, which the Republicans voted on block against, according to the Congressional Budget Office, which based on my 28 years of experience in Congress, was nonpartisan and factual. They said it did add considerably to the gross domestic product. So we're much better off than Europe, which now apparently can barely hold itself together, has in many countries in the EU negative growth rates and very high unemployment. We're much better off than Japan. Think of any country in South America. Brazil, for instance. Everyone knows how terrible it is there from the headlines. Or Venezuela. Think about Russia, whose GDP is declining. Even China is having terrible problems with their industrial overcapacity, their pollution that's killing people. And, of course, the International Court of Arbitration in The Hague just ruled against their territorial claims. So we're not in that bad a position. We're still on top.
Well, Mike Lofken, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Good to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Lofken, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on top Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And he has an article at Consortium News, How the Right Tears Down America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.